I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester. His name is John Anilio, and you're listening to the Functional Nerds. This is going to be episode number 269.
That is correct. Wow, we're really cranking them out these days. That is Patrick Hester. He's an author, a blogger, and a podcaster. You can check him out at acfmb.com and follow him on Twitter. Audio Jedi, that's right. You told me to start saying that. It's Audio Jedi Patrick Hester. I am his Padawan, John Anilio. I am a podcaster and a composer and a musician and a teacher as well. You can check me out at johnanilio.com and follow me on Twitter at John Anilio. Today, we are joined by Elizabeth Bonesteel. She is the author of The Cold Between, a Central Core's novel. It is out now, and it looks fantastic. A great space opera, getting a lot of good reviews. I've been seeing all around the internets these days, so I look forward to getting into that one. And you could check out Elizabeth's website, which is elizabethbonesteel.wordpress.com, and you can follow her on Twitter at liz_monster.
Do you want to spell Bonesteel, John?
B-O-N-E-S-T-E-E-L. Elizabeth, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I was, you know, we were just talking with a recent guest. So were you an early joiner of Twitter with your at Liz Monster, or were you a later Twitter user?
I don't actually know how long I've been on Twitter, but probably earlier, certainly before it sort of exploded into everything. Mm-hmm. It was my brother who encouraged me to do it because he was watching the finale for Battlestar Galactica mm-hmm. interactively on Twitter, and he said that that was actually a really cool thing to do. So since I don't actually get broadcast television anymore, I kind of joined Twitter so I could start following all the TV shows I don't watch.
I can't believe you brought up the finale of Battlestar Galactica. Too soon.
I'm sorry. Too soon.
I remember that actually, because at the time I was using one of the Twitter clients. I believe it was, maybe it was TweetDeck. Which was the black and yellow one? Was TweetDeck black and yellow at some point? I don't remember.
Yeah, kind of, maybe a little bit. I mean, you can customize it. I've only ever used TweetDeck. I hate Twitter.com.
Yeah, so I'd used it, and I remember just having the hashtag BSG on around that week and just having floods of tweets coming down through all that. It was really fun. I remember. I don't think I've really done it for anything since then, but yeah, that's really fun. Lots of interesting things to talk about. It's really interesting, I think, because we had Alan Smale on the podcast a few weeks ago, and he works for NASA. And you have some family history with NASA. So I'm thinking that's a requirement to be on our show now. It's like you yourself or a family member has to work for NASA. So, you know, I'd love to get into that a little bit later in the show when we get to the main part of our interview. But why don't we, you know, get on to our picks of the week. And before we get into our picks, I do want to mention to people that if you like the show, if you like hearing interviews with cool folks like Elizabeth Bonesteel, consider becoming one of our patrons over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. You can pledge $1 a month. You can join the 40 or so people that are already doing that. And it really helps out with the show, and it really means the world to us. So if you like the show, consider becoming one of our patrons over there.
And we have a new milestone goal thing. We hit $200 a month, John will come to the restaurant of your choice and follow you around, kind of with a guitar, like a mariachi kind of thing. It's really mm-hmm. really cool.
Yeah, it's there. It is there. I will do it. I noticed that with all these stretch goals, it's stuff that I have to do, Patrick. I don't know if I'm noticing a theme with that.
Yeah, and let me tell you, his version of some of the classic mariachi songs will just make you cry. I mean, just gorgeous.
Well, thank you, Patrick. That is quite a compliment. Let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And Liz, why don't you go first? What is your pick this week?
Well, I chose a movie. We watch a lot of horror movies in our household because most of what we get for television is either DVDs or streaming Netflix. And you get a lot of really good sort of international low budget stuff off of Netflix. And you get, I think when you go outside of the US, you're much more likely to get horror movies that are sort of moodier rather than bloodier, ghost stories, that kind of stuff. And that's the kind of thing that we enjoy. And this is the film that was sort of a recommended, if you like, that we picked up from Netflix, called Housebound. And it's out of New Zealand. It was 2014. And I actually don't think it is a horror movie, even though it's billed as a horror movie. The basic plot is you have a young woman with a somewhat checkered past who, as part of punishment for having been busted trying to break into an ATM machine, she's put on an ankle bracelet and she's sent back home to live with her mother and her stepfather in this old house that used to be sort of a psychological home for young people. And her mother thinks the house is haunted, and she has complete disdain for this issue until she starts having some of these experiences herself that lead her to believe the house is haunted. And what I like about the film is that you think you know where it's going to take you at every step, but it doesn't go there. It actually does things a little bit differently than what's typical, which isn't to say that it doesn't here and there fall prey to the usual cliches you get with horror films. But it is actually more of a suspense movie, and there's a real sort of strong story underneath it all. It's actually fairly amusing in places. It's really almost a comic horror film. And it's something that, even though having watched it through, I know the whole ending and I know all the hooks, it has a lot of repeat viewing value, which I think is not always true of movies where there's like a big secret behind everything that's going on. Once you know the big secret, you can't go back and watch the film again without thinking, oh yeah, well, I've seen that. So it's something that I enjoy quite a bit and something that I enjoy watching more than once.
Awesome. You were talking about that particular kind of, lesser known kind of horror film. I've been seeing this show up on in various blog posts and things lately, is these the hidden Netflix categories. And I don't know if you've seen any of that stuff or if you've come. So for people who, and Patrick, I don't know if you've come across this at all either, but there are websites now where, so Netflix has this incredible amount of data that they can collect and all of these, and they have all of these different categories that they will order their content into. And what you get in your normal when you go onto Netflix is what they think you are going to want to watch next. But you can go really deep and really specific with the sort of filters that you put on it. And you can have, it's like horror movies from Bulgaria and, like all of these different things. And I've been seeing a lot of those pop up. And it's a way, because as much as we sort of, there's complaints that Netflix doesn't get certain movies, and they don't, they sort of focused on their original content and some other things. There's a tremendous amount of stuff on there, but they can't just throw it all at you at once because it would be overwhelming. So these are really interesting little, if you like sort of off the beaten path films, it's certainly worth investigating these little filters for Netflix to kind of find little gems. Cause it's, we all like different things and stuff that maybe isn't critically acclaimed. It may be just for you. So that just reminded me of that a little bit there. But Patrick, what is your pick this week?
Well, sticking with the movie theme, I am getting ridiculously excited over the Warcraft movie.
Mm. Yeah, I saw that in a new
trailer. And yeah, we keep seeing trailers for it. Ragnar Lothbrok is in it as the human. And that is actually a guy named Travis Fimmel. And yeah, he's on the History Channel Viking show, and and he's playing one of the main leads in this movie. And there's obviously a lot of CGI for this. And as someone who played World of Warcraft for as long as I did, it's ridiculously exciting to see that coming to life as a movie, right? And the trailers that they keep showing are showing a lot of stuff that just makes you kind of squee. And so it's coming very soon. I think it's June when that movie hits. And it just looks amazing. I'm hoping that they keep it well balanced because, there's Alliance versus Horde, obviously, for the Horde. And I don't know. They just – it looks like they're kind of keeping it balanced between the two races and the two empires, essentially, from within World of Warcraft. And I'm hoping that it just doesn't become a Kill the Orcs movie.
Mm. Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to that one too. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I noticed they put that new trailer up. So very cool. Yes.
I specifically like the part where he like jumps off the side of the castle and the eagle catches him, or the griffin, and mm-hmm. because that's not something you can actually do in the game, but that would be so awesome if you could.
Mm. Elizabeth, I think I cut you off there. Were you about to interject?
No, I was not.
Okay,
so there.
Yeah, there you go. Mine, quick pick for me. You know, when I was doing a little research for this interview, I came across a music article that Elizabeth wrote, and talking about her love for various kinds of electronic music. And
I think you've just embarrassed her.
Oh, well, she wrote it. It was not on the internet. It's not like I like rifled through her private journals or anything. But I do want to get into that. But it has something to do with my pick. I compose music for some audio dramas and for some little independent films and things like that. And I just purchased, because they do this to you when you buy stuff, they then give you these deals. But my pick is a company called Native Instruments, and they have a program called Complete with a K. It's just Complete with a K at the beginning. And it's essentially, I bought a sampler from them called Contact, also with a K. That's their theme, which is a sampler that has all sorts of different orchestral sounds and things like that. And Complete is basically everything that they make. You get it. It is literally 400 gigabytes worth of sounds and things, electronic sounds and samples and stuff. And it's normally $1,000, but because I bought that sampler a few months ago, they have a spring deal where it's like, hey, that $1,000 thing is only 400 now. And it's like, I don't really need it, but that's such a good deal. And oh, I'm going to have to get it anyway. So I did. And it's awesome and it's worth it. And I've just gone down the rabbit hole of like exploring all that. I can't actually fit all of it on my computer at once. I don't have that much space on my hard drive, so I'm downloading it a little bit at a time and putting things on external drives and things. But if you like playing around with music, obviously this is a high-end thing, but if you're into that, it's a great deal that they're running right now. So again, it's just Native Instruments Complete. So that, while we're on that topic of music, and we sort of broached it a little bit, why don't you tell us a little bit about your affinity for electronic music,
Liz? it probably started a long time ago. I always tend to blame Mike Oldfield for that a little bit. Because, of course, Tubular Bells, this really long 22 and a half minute, 23 and a half. Sorry, I get a little specific about numbers. Mm-hmm. This long composition, which came out when I was younger than I am now. Just this idea of a longer piece that evolves, which in a way is very much a theme from classical music. Although if you talk to my parents, of course, none of this modern nonsense has anything to do with classical music. We're all just horrible heathens.
Yes, but I had an uncle who said there was no such thing as 4/4 timing.
Yeah, well, yes, I'm familiar with the type. Mm-hmm. But I started, I think probably, it was probably a friend of mine at one of my old jobs who loaned me a Banco de Gaia CD, which was really my first exposure to, I'm not sure, I mean, that was older, so I'm not sure what they'd categorize it as now, probably something between trance and electronica. And I really liked that sound, and iTunes was around at that point, and I started getting to the part where you could, what are other people who've bought this buying, and I started to sniff around, and I ran into Above and Beyond's Tri-State, which is a classic trance album, which is incredible. And I just basically went from there. And at this point, I don't really have a lot of loyalty to specific artists. What I will often do is I'll go to Beatport and I'll pick a category and I'll just run through the samples in the top 20 or top 30 or so tracks, and I'll pick up whatever I like. And I find it's useful for me both for writing, especially if it's non-vocal, for driving long distances, which back when I was when I had a job that took me outside of the house, I drove, my commute was horrendous, and that kept me from, killing people. So it was,
on I-25.
At 495 North. If you live in the area, you know 495 North. It's a nightmare. Maybe not as bad as 93, but it's bad enough. But it's, I find it both sort of energizing and soothing in a way, and it lets my mind drift in a way that can be very useful for me when I'm trying to get some writing done.
You know, you mentioned Mike Oldfield and my college roommate. We listened to that album every day for, and I went to college in like the early 90s. So this was long after it was, you know, a big thing. But I saw it recently. I watched a very good documentary on progressive rock music. And I think the BBC made it. You could find it on YouTube if you just search like British progressive rock or something. And they had a long section on Mike Oldfield. They sort of grouped him in with the other progressive rockers. And I was really surprised with like how big that was for like an instrumental music for like, you know, 20 plus minute long compositions. Like that was a hit. It was, it's so funny to think about that. Yeah. In today's sort of music culture, and you know, that is a very like get off my lawn kids kind of thing. Like you guys don't have the attention span to listen to her. But it's true that you know. But I was surprised because I think a lot of his early compositions were composed for maybe even for like the Olympic Games and things like that. I think he had sort of something to do with that. So he had quite a career. And it does also talking about the progressive rock thing, sort of in a similar vein. I was watching some Emerson, Lake and Palmer videos on YouTube the other day for people who, if you're not a fan of that, Keith Emerson, who was the keyboardist, recently passed away. He was 71, and it was really quite tragic. He committed suicide, and I was showing it to my wife, who's a pianist as well, and we were just like kind of marveling at his ability. We were watching Hoedown, which is that Aaron Copland piece, and their version of it, and you know, unfortunately, our artistic types, they really, we can be quite sensitive. And if we feel like we're getting a lot of negative feedback, I mean, and if you're inclined towards that depressive nature, and it's a tragic story, I think, an artist who had such a great career and to sort of succumb to that and take his own life at 71 too. I don't know. I guess we feel the way we feel. And that's a total bummer that I just brought the whole show down. It's hey, John, let's talk more about suicide. That's great. Good job. Good job.
We can talk about Suicide Squad.
Oh yeah. I suppose we could do that too. But you know, actually let's, you know, I mentioned as sort of a teaser at the beginning of the show about, you know, a lot of, you know, I've read a couple of interviews online. You do talk a little bit about your upbringing and having, I believe it was your grandfather that worked at NASA. Maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit about that and how that maybe influenced you, set up, you know, your background for writing science fiction now.
Well, I think it pretty much set up my whole family because, first of all, I was born in 1964. And that was sort of the height of the space program before we landed on the moon, back when it was, there was a lot of public support for it, I think largely because of the Cold War. So it was sort of this ironic thing, you know, this horrible political situation, but it did give this tremendous public perception that the space program was this very important thing that we did want to spend government money on. And of course, we don't have that kind of perception about it now. But in addition to that, the fact that my mother's father had worked on the Saturn V rocket, we had sort of this personal interest in the whole thing. And so we followed the news. My parents followed the news. And my brother and I just sort of got dragged along with all of that. You know, when you're a little kid, I can look back on it now and realize how remarkable that was, that he was part of that, that I was really this close to all of that. But when I was a little kid, this was just stuff the grownups were talking about. And I actually remember watching Neil Armstrong walking on the moon, which was about, from where we were, it was about 10:30 at night. He had landed, and I think he was on the module for a couple of hours while they were just checking everything out before he went out. And I was a little bit less than 5 years old, and I was annoyed because they were keeping me awake to watch this. So my big memory of watching the first man walk on the moon is I'm irritated and I'm tired and I want to go to bed. But I, you know, I'm also looking around and I'm seeing my parents in tears because it was this amazing thing. And you do realize even when you're little, okay, there's a big thing here that I don't understand. So I will behave myself. And I am so glad, I actually told my dad this yesterday. I'm very, very glad that they did keep me awake for that I have that memory, even if it's a memory of being, you know, this obnoxious little 5 year old who had no idea what she was looking at.
I'm sorry, continue.
No, that's all right. No, go ahead.
Oh, it reminds, you know, one of the, I just picked on our last show, I picked a book by Ed Catmull, who's one of the guys at Pixar. And he talked about his background of when he was a kid, just kind of what you told me just reminded me of that, about how when in the United States, when Sputnik went up, and how, you know, in the United States, that was really seen as a, they're smarter than we are, so we need to get smarter than them. And he talked about how in his school they had, and I cannot think of the name of the program that was launched at the time to really, you know, push science and math to try to like get our generation smarter. And he talked about how that led him down to, you know, getting his degrees in computers and other kinds of things too, and what eventually led to him being at Pixar. But it is kind of a, you know, when you look back at that, it is such a noble thought of just like, yeah, our country thought like, instead of getting, you know, a weird defense, but they're like, no, you know what we have to do? We have to get smarter. That's what and that's not always how things are these days.
You know? Well, and John, at the time, as Liz mentioned, you know, you had the Cold War going on. The ultimate high ground was space.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it basically scared the shit out of a lot of people, Sputnik mm-hmm. did. The fact mm-hmm. that was up there, right, and that the Russians had done that, people are like, we have to do something because now they have the ultimate high ground.
Mm. Now, so Liz, you know, you're talking about that as your experience. So, at what point do you start writing your stories? Is it something that it's from a very young age? How does that sort of come together for you?
I don't know that I always wrote science fiction, but I always wrote. Most of what I read when I was young was science fiction because that was just what was in the house. It wasn't just, you know, my brother and I, my parents would bring that in. Wasn't the only stuff that they read, but in part because of that, you know, they always had, even when public interest kind of started drifting away in the early 70s, there was always still that very strong interest in the space program. And, you know, he and I were both fortunate in that they felt very strongly about us learning. And as you point out, you know, science, let's get smarter. So all of this stuff was brought into the house, you know, with no prejudice, basically. You know, a lot of people my age when they were kids, you know, science fiction was still this thing for children. And we didn't get any of that message. And of course, in the 70s, there was a lot of stuff coming out. So what was the question again?
just at what point do you start telling stories? At what point do you start writing your stories?
I started writing actually before I could actually write, because I it's up on my webpage, just this little blurb, because I couldn't sleep when I was a kid. Hmm. So, and of course, you know, you always, I don't know if either of you have children.
I do.
I have a cat. I don't get to sleep either.
Yeah, I think cats in some ways are actually worse.
Yes,
because they don't grow out of it.
Yes,
but
and it's basically paw in the face. It's time to play. No,
yes,
it's 4 actually, o'clock in the morning. It's time to sleep.
Yes, that actually does sound a lot like small children. but you know, there's this phase where if they can't sleep, they want you to sit with them. You know, somebody sit with me. I don't care what you do. I'm just going to stare at you for hours and hours. And the adults are thinking, somebody save me from this. Why did I have this child? And yeah, you laugh like you never thought that. But eventually what they told me is, you know, look, you know, we could sit here or you could just make up some stuff. You know, use your imagination, tell yourself stories, stop calling us in here in the middle of the night, you know, entertain yourself, kid. And of course, in a very kind way, they did that. But I did actually start doing that when I would lie awake at night and I couldn't sleep, I would make up stories. So I've really, it's been sort of part of how I deal with the world around me my whole life is just making stuff up. And the science fiction aspect just comes from the environment that I was brought up in.
Hmm. And, you know, why not, maybe, you know, you could tell us a little something about, you know, because a lot of the reviews that I've read of The Cold Between, they do mention Star Trek a little bit. And I want to know a little bit something about your feelings about Star Trek.
Well, of course, I was raised with Star Trek because we watched everything that smacked even slightly of science fiction on television, including Lost in Space and Giant Carrots and the whole thing. But I actually wrote a post on the Mary Sue, I think, where I talked a little bit about Star Trek and the original show. I probably didn't watch much of it when it was first run, but I certainly watched it when it was on reruns. And so Star Trek has sort of been a part of everything as I was growing up. And I think what appealed to me about that, and probably at least some of what people are referring to when they're talking about its relationship to this book, is this idea that maybe the future won't be this hideous dystopia where we're all, you know, eating each other. Hmm. Maybe it will actually be okay.
Yes.
We've figured
out our problems and we've stopped fighting each other. We're going to go out into the galaxy and start fighting other things.
Yes. Yes. And start causing problems for other people. Although there's, I have no aliens in this book. But the idea that, I mean, I did sort of, and it is a little bit of a cheat that you kind of leapfrog a lot of the issues that we're dealing with as a species today to a period of time where we've gotten past these issues and are now facing a whole set of different issues. So that is, I suspect, what a lot of people are talking about when they make that connection, because I think there probably is that connection, because Star Trek, whatever else it is extremely optimistic in terms of how it draws the future. And, you know, there's a lot of science fiction out there, Battlestar, for example, that is less optimistic. Mm-hmm. Although, strictly speaking, I gather that was supposed to be the past, but you know what I'm saying. Mm-hmm.
Those who believe that life down there began out there.
Exactly. Exactly. But, you know, I'm fundamentally, I prefer optimistic stories, and I write what I like to read. So that's really what led me to that for this book.
Now you were saying when you were young, you and your family consumed, you know, anything that was remotely science fiction. And you were also saying, something I came across online was that a lot of what, after the success of things like Star Wars and Star Trek, you know, is basically, let's just, you know, slap some spaceships in there and it'll be good to go. And so, unfortunately, at the time, there was a lot of low quality, you know, science fiction and movies and TV.
No!
But nowadays, yeah. I think particularly with television specifically, we do have a lot of higher quality things. And I think in a lot of ways, that's just TV overall. And I think because of things like Netflix, where people can just watch every episode and all of that, I think just the medium has changed where that form of storytelling really works. Do you think there's other reasons why we're just in a higher, there's just much higher quality TV these days in terms of science fiction than there were in the past?
I think part of it is, like I said before, when I was a kid, science fiction was often viewed as a thing for children. Hmm. And I don't think that's the case anymore. And I think that's largely because people of my generation and the generations that came after me were raised with it and got comfortable with it as a storytelling medium. And now that we are adults, we're sort of asserting that in the marketplace. You know, we want this. Yes, this can tell serious stories. See all of these books that you guys used to ignore. You know, a lot of the stuff that was written when I was growing up is incredibly serious and still really works very well. In regards to television in particular, I think because of the market right now with Netflix and Amazon and these places and sci-fi, because I'm a huge fan of The Expanse, all of this stuff that's coming out now, they're taking chances because there's a lot of competition going on. I mean, everybody knows Amazon will basically, you know, they'll eat their young to get something out there. You know, they will take chances on this stuff. And I think Hollywood tends to be very conservative about what they think is going to do well. So they take something, well, okay, everybody liked this movie, so let's make a sequel to this movie, or let's make something different, but that has similar special effects. And they don't take chances, and they don't pay enough attention to storytelling. And I think television is the perfect medium for that kind of thing, because you do get these networks and these producers that are more willing to take chances on new ideas, and they do have a longer span on which they can spin the story out, which is for a lot of science fiction much more satisfying than a 90-minute or 2-hour film.
You mentioned The Expanse. Did you read the books first, or did you watch the show?
I have read the first book. I have the next two. I loved the first book so much, and I was so afraid that I would hate the sequels that I didn't read them. But yes, and part of what happened when I was watching the show, and why couldn't we binge watch that? I was really upset about that. but about halfway through, I realized they're not even going to get through the first book in the first season. But it's marvelous because I'm watching it with my daughter who hasn't read any of the books. So this is all new to her, which is fabulous. And I know some of the stuff that's happening, but there's an awful lot going on that is completely new to me. And so it's like, it really is like something entirely new, even though part of it's familiar.
Right. Because there's elements from the second and some of the novellas, you know, the second book and some of the novellas are because like Amos mentions the churn. You've got Avasarala is in there, which
she's not in the first book.
and so I've said it before. I absolutely loved the books, and I went through the audiobooks with Jefferson Mays narrating them, and they just blew me away. And so I was really prepared for the TV show. And so it's interesting. Are you struggling with any of the stuff that's not in the first book? Like the
no.
Okay.
No, I don't. I actually think it does a pretty good job of keeping you up to date with the story. Like I said, I know some of it.
Given how they started it when they jammed so much into that first episode, I was starting to get worried that the last episode they were going to jam everything from the end of the book into there. So I was actually happy that they didn't.
Yes, yes. Oh, I'm glad. I'm glad that they're taking longer to tell the story, but you know, 2017, what are you doing to me?
Well, and I think that points out to, and, you know, obviously that's the Sci-Fi Channel that's making that. And we interviewed James S.A. Corey, who, as most people I think know, that's Daniel Abraham and Ty Frank. And, you know, I think that's kind of unusual in that they're in the writer's room on that show. So they're, you know, TV didn't just be like, we're going to buy this and we know what we're doing. They're like, hey, you're the folks who wrote it. So we want your input on this too. And
which
I think
really unusual, John. Really unusual.
And I think that points to what Liz was talking about in terms of taking chances, you know, instead of just trying to make something like, oh, we need a new Battlestar or we need a new whatever. They're like, well, let's see, these books did quite well, so maybe we should get the folks that wrote them to have some input.
To your point and to Liz's point, everything you read online is like, oh, this is the new Battlestar. This is the new Battlestar, comparing it to Battlestar.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that's the only thing Hollywood has to compare this to.
Yeah, I think that shorthand that I mean, look, we see it with books all the time. And I think as a consumer of books, I'm okay with it because you need to give people a frame of reference. Like you need to be, you know, like because we're so fortunate to get all these books and I have very nice relationships with a lot of the publicists. And, you know, but when you get those, it's like it's Firefly meets this and it's like, well, yeah, because you need to sort of give somebody a little bit of an idea in two sentences of, is this the kind of book that I may want to read? So I'm okay with that. I mean, I understand like, yeah, it's like, well, does everything have to be Firefly crossed with Sherlock, crossed with The Walking Dead or what? You know, it's like it's zombies in space.
Yeah, but right now, John, we actually do get a lot of people in publishing in New York who listen to the show and we've had feedback from that. And I just want to say that you just got a, like a bunch of people going, really? Firefly versus Sherlock? Tell me more. Really?
Yeah, well, you know, if these ideas, my consulting fee is very reasonable. But we're starting to come to the end of our time. But before we do that, you know, this is The Cold Between is the first novel, but it says a Central Core's novel. So I'm assuming there are going to be more books in this series. Is that the plan, Liz?
Yes, the second one is coming out this fall. It's actually up for pre-order on Amazon already. It's called Remnants of Trust, and it starts 6 months or so after the end of this one.
Now, is it? Do you have a deal for the two books, or do you have multiple?
Three.
Like three. Okay, awesome. So we can expect at least three. So that is
yes.
Awesome. That is really good. Okay, so before we wrap it up, I do want to say that you know, once again, Liz's website is elizabethbonesteel.wordpress.com, and her Twitter handle is @Liz_Monster. Where's the monster come from?
I work
nice. Very
exactly.
Good.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I worked at a job for a while, and one of the guys that I worked with when I would come in the morning, he would see me from across, you know, because they have the big cube farm and you can see people from across the room, and he'd yell out, "Liz Monster," when I arrived in the morning. I have no idea why, but that's been my nickname for about 20 years. So
very good. And, you know, so people can find you online. They can go and buy your book and pre-order the second book right now. Mm-hmm. And are you going to be making any appearances at upcoming conventions?
I will be at ReaderCon in Quincy.
Okay.
In July. I don't have anything else booked at the moment. I have some travel restrictions in that I don't fly. Mm. So
at all?
I last flew in 1999.
That must have been one hell of a flight.
It's a long story and not very interesting, but in any case, that makes appearances a little bit difficult, but I am going to be at ReaderCon, and there's some talk about other stuff, but for now, that's the only one I've got booked.
And ReaderCon, this is the ReaderCon in Massachusetts, is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, in Quincy, Mass.
Yeah. Oh yeah, where was it before Quincy? Because I was at
Burlington.
Okay, that's right. Yeah, that's if you're anywhere in that area, that's a great con to go to, especially if you are into the literary side of science fiction. It is a very like book focused con. So if you are a listener of the show and you are in the Massachusetts area or within driving distance at all, I really encourage you to check it out. There are some very, very good panels, a lot of authors there. You're not going to see a lot of cosplay or anything like that or gaming or things like that. So if you go to cons for that sort of thing, it might not be your cup of tea. But if you like to really, you know, get in deep with some pretty intellectual types of panels and things. I really enjoyed it. I went about 5 or 6 years ago, and I've been, because I live in New Jersey, so it's not too far from me. And I have to get back up to one again.
I'm disappointed that they moved it out of Burlington, because when it was there, you didn't have to bring your own coat.
I believe that's Burlington, Vermont, where the coat factory is.
Hey, that joke works anywhere there's a coat.
I suppose. All right. For us, once again, yeah, if you dig the show, go over to our Patreon page, patreon.com/functionalnerds. Consider becoming one of our patrons if you enjoy these kinds of conversations with cool folks like Liz. And that's it for us. Patrick, anything you want to mention before we go?
Not really.
All right. All right. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us. Best of luck with this novel and the next one. And you'll have to come back when your next book comes out.
Thank you very much.
All right, everyone. Have a great week. We'll see you next time.
Thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?